Professor Ted Lefroy from the Centre of Environment at the University of Tasmania has come to put a question mark at the end of the sentence, the survival of the fittest. Hello, Ted.
Morning, Rick.
So this is a bit like the tragedy of the commons, which you spoke about, where we've believed this idea for a long time, and yet people have questioned it substantially, but the questioning hasn't quite got into the mainstream.
That's right. In fact, we've got to go right back to the person who coined the expression, who wasn't actually Darwin. It was a man called Herbert Spencer. And he read Darwin's book, Origin of Species, and he was at the time writing his theory of everything. Amazing.
Which book. Every gentleman was doing.
Of course, exactly. And he wrote the principles of biology, he wrote principles of psychology. He wanted a theory of evolution that went from the material through the biological to human to everything. And he interpreted the idea of the struggle for existence as the survival of the fittest, but he wasn't using fit in the sense that we do. In fact, the sense that we often use it now, that's physically fit, wasn't even in common usage then. So what he was meaning is fit as in jigsaw, not fit as in gym. Fit as in suited to the circumstances, well suited to circumstances.
So this idea of survival of the fittest, which we sort of link to nature, red in tooth and claw, it was exactly. More like the most appropriate.
Exactly.
And suitablest.
Yeah, and biologically, fitness is evolutionary success. Your ability to reproduce and pass on your genes. So it's reproductive fitness. It's not physical fitness. So there's the first thing, right?
So it's actually more like the streets idea of you're fit and you know it.
It is.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So as in, you know, you think of fit and proper person.
Mm.
There's a lot of meanings of fit if you look at the Shorter Oxford. It's actually got six. So it's tricky territory. So a lot of people grabbed that idea, like Andrew Carnegie, who was an American industrialist and capitalist, and he thought that's exactly what I need to justify his great belief in free market capitalism. But you can pick and choose, you know. If you looked at a bee colony or a termite mound, you could say cooperation. You know, it's the survival of the cooperator. So, and what both of those examples do—that is, picking something in nature and saying human society should be like that—is called the naturalistic fallacy. Because you see something is in nature, doesn't mean it ought to be in human society. You know, turning an is into an ought. And that is what people have done with that idea ever since.
Very dangerous. It's, for example, if you look at chimpanzees and how they behave, well, certainly if you're Jane Goodall and you leave big piles of bananas around, is that they fight over them.
Yeah.
But if you look at bonobos, they just make love all the time and share everything.
Yeah. But it's about what is best suited to your environment. So people, ever since that expression, survival of the fittest, came out, wondered if that was actually true. And back in 1902, a Russian called Peter Kropotkin wrote a book saying mutual aid. He said mutual aid is as important to evolution as mutual struggle. And ever since then, people have argued and argued that we are just as hardwired for cooperation as we are for competition. But there is no, the interesting thing is there is no evidence of that. It seems to be cultural evolution that supports cooperation. It's not hardwired into us genetically.
Why is cooperation a plus? Why is that an advantage to cooperate?
Because
if you're cooperative, some harder, meaner person will just take advantage of you and say,
True, but it comes back to your environment and it comes back to your circumstances as to which is most beneficial. There's a fascinating study that recently came out in Science where an American social scientist living in China observed that the cultural differences between the North and the South were quite dramatic. And he wondered if it wasn't to do with their basic subsistence agriculture. Okay, so in the South, it's basically a rice culture. In the North, it's wheat. In order to grow rice, you need to cooperate. It's a very intensive crop. You've got to plant the seedlings by hand. You need to get people around to harvest it. Wheat doesn't require the same level of cooperation. Now, you'd think that wouldn't hold because it's now mechanized. So why should that still remain? But what he did is an interesting little test where he got people to draw what they call sociographs. You draw a picture of you, yourself and your immediate network as circles. And the people from the more cooperative cultures, their own self circle was quite small and they had many others that they were connected to. In the wheat culture, the circle they drew is much bigger relative to the others and they had fewer connections. Now, you might think that's a bit tenuous, but they've done the same thing in the United States in the 90s. And those areas that were settled by people from an agricultural background are far less tolerant of violence than those that are settled by people who came from herders or pastoralists, where they're far more accepting of violence because they had to protect their livestock. Their wealth is in small number of highly mobile things that can easily disappear in the middle of the night, but no one's going to come and take your wheat crop. And even though it's 200 years since people had to behave like that, those norms still exist within society.
So then you've got this chart, haven't you, of like rice people are the nicest, wheat people are more selfish, and then, you know, herders, they're just look out.
Well, yeah, but I'm wary of nice. It's
hence
about
the cowboy culture, isn't it?
Well, the Wild West. Yeah, it sort of goes some way. But I think I'd be wary of saying nice or good or bad. It just is, you know, fitting into your environment. There's a game called The Ultimate Game, and I've tried it all over the world. You go to a pair of people and you say to the one of them, I'm going to give you some money, but you only get it if you can negotiate with the second person how you share it. Now, in America, in Israel, in Slovenia, wherever they've tried it, the usual thing is the first person who's given the money offers the other person half and they accept and it's split. If your offer is not accepted, nobody gets any money. Now, they tried it with a small group deep in the Amazon, quite isolated, living in forest. The average amount that the first person offered was 15%, and 95% of the respondents accepted.
You wouldn't get that here.
No, and the culture there was people looked after their immediate family, but there was intense competition between families. Now, there's something about their environment where broader cooperation was not to their advantage socially. So it's about the environment, and we come back to fitness.
So how do you know then, Ted? It's 6:45 on 936 ABC Hobart. Ted Lefroy is the director of the Centre for Environment at the University of Tasmania, and we're exploring the idea of the survival of the fittest. Whether cooperation or competition is, in fact, I guess, the way to get ahead. And not really so much in life, is it? But as a species, genetically and over time in terms of breeding. So how do you know when to apply the rules of competition and when do you apply the rules of cooperation, evolutionary speaking?
Okay, well, I reckon there's two different processes at work. A lot of competition is hardwired in the sense that we have an innate sense to protect ourselves and those immediately related to us. There's a famous biologist, Haldane, who once said...
It's called the jobs for the boys gene.
It's genes for the family. It is like that, exactly. But he said, I would lay down my life for two brothers or four nephews or eight cousins. And what he's talking about there is actually the quantitative amount of genetic material they have in common. And another thing he said was, an ounce of algebra is better than a ton of theory. And there have been tons of theory in the last century about cooperative behavior and group selection and altruism, but you can't say it's hardwired. So to answer your question, social norms determine when it's better for us to cooperate or not cooperate. And our innate sense of survival and wanting to ensure the survival of our kin and those close to us is hardwired. So when you say, when do you choose? In a lot of ways, we don't have a lot of choice. There are social norms acting on us to cooperate in our society or not. And then there are our genes, which provide a very strong incentive to survive and protect those related to us.
Which suggests you need the strictest laws in terms of integrity to prevent people from favouring their families if you want the kind of civil society that we have.
Which is what exactly...
Because you're fighting the deepest needs.
Which is exactly what has happened, you know, if you think that government in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, even in Britain, was a sinecure. You looked after your immediate tribe, you know, and it was jobs for the boys.
That was the expectation.
Exactly. But a meritocracy, China was hundreds of years ahead of the West in terms of having a government that was based on a meritocracy. We've now sort of caught up with that, and they've gone on a different path.
It's nearly 7:00 on 9:30.